The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
In 1910, the New York film studio of Thomas Edison created an adaptation of Mary Shelley's gothic novel, Frankenstein. The film was a commercial failure. It would be 20 years before the rise of the American horror film. Between 2003 and 2008, 135 horror titles grossed nearly $3 billion at the box office. Hundreds more were produced for home video, proving that the genre still has plenty of lifeblood, and prompting some to wonder why American viewers are so obsessed with violence. How did we get here?
If a horror film is cutting off people's thumbs and gouging their eyes out, I guess that's a certain kind of horror film, but it's certainly not the kind of horror film that interests me.
The appeal of horror movies has always been about confronting death, and in their various ways, these movies, you know, help us cope with that, and that's one of the reasons that this has been such a long-lived genre, even from literary times on.
Fear is probably the most powerful emotion we all feel as humans. We're all afraid of death and loss of a loved one, loss of identity, all the things that you see in a movie, we're all afraid of.
In my mind, what makes a good horror movie is something that stays with you after the credits go and you're in the car and you're driving home and that next morning when you wake up.
If you meet all the people who make horror films, you discover they are very nonviolent. They're politically active and knowledgeable and anti-war. They have opened themselves up to all of these possibilities, and it's the people who repress them who are the ones you have to look out for.
I always had this affinity towards the great universal monsters. Not sure where that came from, other than probably being a boy who felt like he was not particularly good looking and felt like a freak.
I love the monsters. I mean, that goes back to those days at the RKO Castle Hill, when even though Frankie was bothering me a little bit there, I still sympathized with him, and I've always sympathized with the monsters.
Hi, I'm Lance Henriksen, and you're in the projection booth.
Joseph, thank you again for coming on the projection booth. It's a pleasure to talk to you once again. I know we'll be hearing more from you and Lance Henriksen in a few months' time when we talk about The Visitor, one of Lance's favorite films, it sounds like. And I wanted to ask you, before we get into even the book project, what is your background?
For the last 10 years, done a fair amount of television. And also written a few books. I've done mostly sort of Discovery Channel shows, crime shows, and I did a fun-to-make ghost story series called A Haunting. I was one of the episode producers on that. And have written three books. The book with Lance is my third. I wrote a book that was published in 2004 on horror films, American horror films, called Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue. And I wrote a book that was published in 2009 on T.S. Eliot. I guess because after doing horror films, I figured why not go completely the other direction and alienate any readers that I might have. And it actually was a great process writing that book. I spent about 5 years writing that, and it sort of dictated for 5 years really everything that I was thinking and the way that I was even interacting with people. So it was a great process doing that. And in a lot of ways, doing the book with Lance was kind of the same thing, that he's such a grounded person that he's really inspiring not only in terms of his career, but in terms of the way he lives his life. So, I think I picked up a lot from him, a lot of things from him that I will probably use in my career and will probably use personally going forward. So, I've been lucky to do a lot of things that keep me happy.
Yeah, I was very curious when I saw the T.S. Eliot thing. I was like, this has got to be a different Joseph Madry. You know, their film, you know, their bibliographies got mixed up somewhere. So that's awesome. That is so cool.
I remember right after it was published, I did a blog post, actually, where I tried to connect them. They are actually connected in my mind, and it's probably a bit of a stretch for anybody else. But I was actually writing, I wrote a blog comparing Eliot's poem "The Wasteland" to "Night of the Living Dead," so there is actually some overlap in my warped imagination. You know, just in terms of how you live with fear, how you approach fear, you know, is kind of the common ground for me. But I don't know. That's not a conversation that comes up that often. Usually, it's people want to talk about T.S. Eliot or they want to talk about horror movies. I don't get a lot of people who are, you know, really ready to go into both. So.
Right. Yeah. There's always that awkward moment at cocktail parties, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's sort of like I went to a T.S. Eliot conference in London, an academic conference a few years ago. And as soon as they start asking what else you do and where you're from, I mean, you know, you say, well, I'm from Los Angeles and I write about horror movies. And boy, that really shuts down the London academics.
Oh, yeah. I was very curious how the Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue came about as a book first, and then eventually how it became a movie.
It was a book that I wrote. Actually, it was an independent study that I did as an undergraduate in college, just because I needed to do an independent study to get enough credits to graduate with a film minor and still graduate on time. So I came up with that idea as an independent study just because I'm obsessive and was watching a lot of horror movies anyway. And I'm also sort of compulsive about wanting to organize my thoughts on anything I'm really interested in. So I sort of, you know, conned my way into getting college credit for that, and then graduated. Had no idea really what I was going to do for money. And one of the directions I went in was to try to get the manuscript published. And McFarland, one of the companies that I submitted it to, came back and they said, you know, this is sort of well-trodden ground, but we like your writing style. So they wanted me to take another pass at it, make it a little bit longer. It was just an independent study, so it was probably only half of the length of the finished book. And I spent the next couple of years probably doing that. I started working on Discovery Channel things and, you know, was doing production. So it's, you know, 12 to 15 hour days. It took me a couple of years to actually be able to go back and finish that book. And then I moved to LA a couple of years after that. And somebody came calling, was hunting down the book to try to get the rights and make the documentary themselves. And I think they got about a year into it and were really sort of flailing, had shot a couple of interviews, but were pretty unfocused about where they wanted to go with it. So the guy who had paid for the book rights said, you know, you've done some production work, obviously. How would you feel about taking the ball and running with it? And I called my editor Andrew and we said, well, why not? This will be fun. And you know, we both had full-time jobs, but we don't like sleeping that much, so let's tackle it, see where it goes.
It's such a wonderful documentary. I mean, I've seen it a few times now, and it's one of those. I mean, there aren't a whole lot of documentaries that I watch repeatedly, but this one seems to offer something new every time I watch it, and I will catch something that somebody has said because it's just so packed with information. Mm-hmm. But how on earth did you get all of those guys to be in that doc? Because it is just such an all-star cast.
Persistence, I think, mainly. I mean, I sent copies of the book to a lot of the guys that I was pursuing as interview. I mean, you know, honestly, when you get right down to it, I only got about half of the people that I was going after. You know, and I was pretty aggressive about some of the people that I ended up not getting for different reasons. But I did have a tremendous amount of luck. I mean, I think it was really just about calling these guys, managing to get them or their assistants on the phone, and also sending out letters, sending out copies of the book, and just really making my case for how I would present their films within that larger context, and what I personally felt about their visions and what was unique about their films, and just, you know, basically trying to convince them that, you know, that I was going to do this professionally, but that I was also really personally invested in having them individually involved. And I was very specific about who I wanted. You know, there was, you know, kind of the top tier, and then there was the second tier. And I'm sure anybody who makes, you know, who writes a book like this or does a documentary like this, everybody's going to have a certain amount of personal bias. You know, everybody has their favorites. And of course, anybody who's talked about the Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue documentary on the internet, they all happily express their bias and say, well, this person's irrelevant and this person would have been more relevant. And why did they, you know, focus on this film but not include this film? I mean, you know, you have to get personal with it because that's, I mean, you know, otherwise, what's the point? You really are doing a clip reel. So I did things that resonated with me, and I focused on a lot of the ideas about these films in context that feel right to me, that feel like they're a part of the film's success. And you know, I was free to bring that personal bias into it and discard things that I thought were going a little too far. You know, I don't think we went too much into psychoanalysis. because I think that can get kind of heavy-handed, and I wanted to do something that was a little bit surfacey, you know, and actually in a way a little bit superficial, because I think when you delve too deep into some of this stuff, you know, the hidden meaning behind a film, you start to get away from the fun of the film. And so that was one reason. And also we got all these clips. I mean, we also have clips from, God, I don't know, it's got to be over 200 films, and we were doing that under fair use. So you've got to really be very specific about how an individual clip fits in with your narrative, and be pretty sparing about that. So we had to keep up the frenetic pace, and I'm glad it works.
Yeah, I was curious about the clips because you just have so many in there. How did you use fair use, if you don't mind me asking, in order to get around having to beg all the studios, and who knows who owns the rights to a lot of those things?
Yeah, well, the key for what we did, and a lot of this is on, you know, Lux Digital Pictures, that they had planned to do this documentary using fair use. And, you know, I mean, it comes down to just kind of understanding the basic concept and writing your narrative with you know, the concept of fair use, that you're not, for instance, going to be putting out a product that undercuts the sales of anybody else's product. You know, I mean, basically we approached this and said, well, we're going to do a, you know, a giant 90-minute advertisement for about 200 different films. You know, I can't imagine that anybody watches, you know, a 5-second clip and goes, oh, well, now I don't need to see that film. You know, I don't need to go buy that. You know, what we wanted to do was to you know, to do a giant advertisement, but also to do it in an intelligent way where we're threading all of those things together. And you know, I found that a lot of people responding to the documentary say, I have to go back and watch 100 movies now, you know, that I just piled a whole bunch of titles on my Netflix queue or whatever. And, you know, I think that speaks well of the documentary, that's sort of what it should do. I mean, it should make you go back and look at some of those films in maybe a different light.
Right. Who were some of your white whales that you were trying to get but weren't able to?
I feel guilty bringing that up and naming names. I'll tell you that among my absolute top tier, I really desperately wanted Wes Craven. That was one that I can say I really didn't feel like I should make the documentary without that interview. And he left. Let's see, the day that I started calling around, the week I started calling around to try to set up interviews, he about 3 days before that had left for Connecticut to start scouting locations for his film 25/8, which came out as My Soul to Take. And so he was just immersed in that for the entire production period of the documentary. And you can't really argue with that. You can't say, you know, come do my documentary because it's more important than the new Wes Craven movie. So, you know, I mean, you just sort of take it. Like I said, I had an obligation to, you know, to the financier to deliver a film on a set date. So, you know, that was one of those things that I couldn't wait any longer. But I ended up actually going to John Muir, who was one of the later interviews that I did, and he had written a book on Wes Craven. So I had all of these things that I wanted to talk about with Wes, and I just said, John, I'm gonna kind of double up on you and ask you the Wes Craven questions too, and we'll see what you come out with. And he came out with that great bit about comparing Freddy Krueger to Ronald Reagan, which I think is probably one of the moments that's most commented on in the entire documentary. So he's certainly something to work with.
Yeah, I love that moment. I love that the doc gets underneath the skin of a lot of the films, but it isn't too heavy handed. And it's kind of, as you were saying before, the psychoanalysis of it. So I think that you've got a really good balance in the film of those two things, like between fanboy and taking apart the film and examining every single facet of it. I think you tread that line right down the middle.
Sure. And have fun with it. I mean, that's, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, you can delve into a lot of these films and a lot of the work of these, you know, big name filmmakers and come up with some pretty profound stuff, but, you know, but it's also fun. I mean, you don't want to undercut, you know, one of the reasons that you keep going back, which is, you know, which is the thrill ride, you know, and you can't scare people with a documentary like this. So it's, you know, one of the reference points that I had, an obvious reference point, was the documentary that Adam Simon did called The American Nightmare, which really takes just a single decade, and I think it was sort of five or six key filmmaker interviews, but it's very narrowly focused, and it's very, the tone of it is completely different. It had has a really sort of brooding atmosphere. I love that documentary. I would never knock that documentary. I mean, it's fantastic. But I went into mine going, all right, I want to do something completely different. I want to open it up. I want it to be much broader, and I want it to have to be fast paced and not that sort of you know, brooding atmosphere. I mean, that was a conscious decision early on, and I knew my editor too would go for that. That fits his. He's a natural trailer editor, so I knew he would love that style.
Very cool. And then that's what led you to Lance, correct?
It is. Lance did the narration for the documentary. I thought he would be the perfect. And not only does he have that resonance in his voice, the perfect voice, but I thought he would be able to do that sort of subtle balance of seriousness and humor. I mean, when you're going, you know, in a 5-minute period from talking about you know, the Holocaust to giant bugs created by radiation. I mean, you're covering a pretty wide spectrum there. And I felt like he, you know, without being obvious about it, could hit, you know, hit the different notes that he could be, you know, he could sound a little bit tongue in cheek, you know, at some parts, but also he can be, so, you know, as anybody who's has seen him in anything knows, he can be deadly earnest.
Right, yeah, and that's what really comes across in the book, is just how serious he is at times. I mean, he does seem to have a good time with things, but there are points where it's just like, wow, this guy is really into his craft. I mean, or I should say crafts. I mean, the pottery, the art, and the acting all seem to have very equal weight to him.
Yeah, well, he is a very intense person, and I think the reason that he's so serious about all that art is that he doesn't really make the distinction between his life and his art. And I don't mean that he goes around, you know, acting like his characters, or that he's a method actor who stays in his role all the time. I just mean that he it's not a hobby for him. You know, I mean, those roles and what he does on screen, it really is a part of who he is, that he brings himself to those roles a lot, you know, a lot of personal stuff, a lot of personal experiences and ideas and thoughts. So he brings a lot to the table in the roles. And then I think the roles inform, you know, inform who he is a lot going forward, that he's looking to learn from. I mean, that he said that film is basically his education, the people he's worked with, the other artists he's worked with. You know, those are the people who educated him, because he didn't have a traditional education, and he didn't have, you know, a structured family upbringing. And so he really did, he became the person he is through art. And that's, you know, that's why it's serious for him. It would never occur to him, honestly, to look at it any other way.
So I jumped a little bit ahead of myself, going back to him recording the documentary narration. I just have this picture in my head, like old school recording studio, very low lights, you know, just that one light over his head, maybe one over yours. He's reading what you've written, and you're just like, it maybe gets off topic between takes or something and starts telling some stories, and you're just like, wow, this guy is super fascinating. Is that just completely my Hollywood way of thinking how this book idea started, or is there any truth to that at all?
I don't remember the lighting, but yeah, I mean, he really would. He would pause and he would tell a story, and you know, we took periodic breaks, you know, and he'd go out for a cigarette and tell a story, and you know, or he would just pause in the middle, you know, in between takes, and kind of, you know, rattle off about you know, well, one day I was on the set with Steven Spielberg when we were shooting Close Encounters, and just kind of go into this tale. Yeah, we were pretty focused during the session for the most part, the voiceover session, because you know you're paying for it. But he came out of the booth after that and sat down and just started to talk very casually about a lot of different things. We got into a pretty long discussion about pottery, and I knew that he'd done pottery, and I didn't then and still don't know much about it. As an art form, except what he's told me. But he really opened up. I mean, it would have been so easy for him to say, okay, well, we've done the narration and now I'm going home. And he didn't do that. He sat and talked to me for in my mind, it's like an hour or two. And very casually. And so we stayed in touch after that, a little bit because of the pottery thing. We were actually talking for a while about trying to develop a reality show, a TV reality show that would revolve around him and some of his pottery buddies, and we played with that for that idea for about a year, and it was starting to lose a little bit of steam for a bunch of different reasons. We may end up coming back to it, but it was starting to lose some steam, and I knew that I didn't want to lose contact with him. So I think what actually prompted the book idea was, I don't know if you're familiar with a book called Sigology by Verne. And I was just reading it. I loved that book. And I there was a section in it where he's talking about the film Pistol Whipped. And he goes off on like a 2 or 3 page rant about how great Lance is. And I just, you know, it was like the light bulb went off. And I said, why is there not a book like this about Lance's movies? So I think I was on the phone with him that afternoon and just sort of threw out the idea. And at that point I was just thinking of a filmography based book that I would write and maybe he'd give me an interview for it. I actually wasn't thinking initially in terms of biography, but he said, yeah, let's do it. Just sort of off the cuff. He said, if you'd asked me a year ago, I would have said no. And every time anybody's ever asked me to do a book, I've always said no. But he said, let's get into it and let's see where it goes. If we're not happy with it, we'll scrap it. And if we are happy with it, we'll keep going.
So what do you think changed for him in that year between?
I think a lot of writing this book was just a trust thing, you know, that we had been having dialogues over the course of the year. And I put a lot of time and energy into trying to develop the TV show thing and showing a genuine interest in pottery and getting some more of his, you know, his personal stories out of him, just, you know, just as sort of a byproduct of having conversations with him about something else. And, you know, I think it was, we had a rapport, and I think we had enough of a rapport that he felt like he could say, if this doesn't go somewhere, we're going to scrap it and trust me to actually scrap it. And so, you know, that it was a comfort level thing. I mean, it's a tough, I think he'd always felt, you know, that he had a lot of things in his life that he didn't want to do a book that was going to sound like a pity party. You know, look at how hard my life has been. He didn't want to do that. And he didn't want to be judged for his mistakes, you know, defined by his mistakes. He wanted to be, you know, defined by the way he responded to them and what he learned from them. And to in telling his story, allow other people to learn from the things that he'd done wrong and the things he'd done right. I mean, he wanted it to have a purpose for the reader. You know, he didn't feel the need to do a big confessional for his own sake. I mean, that would be an ego thing, and he doesn't really have that side to him. But he plays things pretty close to the chest generally. So I think it was really just a trust thing.
So I'm curious how the actual interviews went. I mean, you know, some of this stuff is just so personal. Did he come in and lay down on the couch and you just kind of took it down? Or, I mean, because, guys, you got some great stories out of him, but it sounds like he's not hesitant to tell some of the stories, but some of them seem to get really personal.
Once he'd made up his mind that he was going to do this, he had no aversion to taking the risks and just saying, this is who I am. Let's put it out there. And we had to get to that point. I mean, I think we did almost a full draft where I'd been taking him chapter by chapter and we'd been talking through everything and making changes. And we really hadn't talked through that much of his childhood. We pretty much started our interviews with his theater background because I was able to dig up some research on that and learn enough to know him what plays to ask about and who he'd worked with and that sort of thing. And so that was really where I started with the Q&A stuff. And then once we went through all of his films, we actually got to a point where he said, you know, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. Let's talk through all of the early stuff. And then once he opened up and basically told me the content of that very first chapter, we went back and talked a lot of the movies because I said, well, you know, this scene in this particular movie obviously came out of personal experience on some level. And, you know, that really made the book much more integrated. I mean, the overlaps between his life and his art became much more apparent. And you know, once we got into that, I mean, he talks about this point where the book, you know, he says basically we got to a point where the book wrote itself, which is one of those things that, you know, as the writer, you don't really, you know, it sort of gets under your skin a little bit because, you know, I'm going, well, wait a minute. I was sitting there writing, you know, every day for how many months? It wasn't writing itself, trust me. But, you know, but on the other hand, I know exactly what he means. I mean, all of a sudden we got to this point where he said, okay, this is what the book is and this is its purpose. And you know, we had been exploring up until that point, but it really came into focus. And I don't think it was too long after that that I was talking to another horror journalist named Allison Nastasi, and she said, I want to give you a book recommendation, a book title recommendation, Not Bad for a Human. And it just sort of gelled. We said, yeah, that's the book.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the title. I love that it's a reference. But then also I heard an interview that he did on Rue Morgue where he was saying, you know, how he kind of has become human over the years.
Yeah, sure. And then he had to learn everything by trial and error. You know, I mean, that's the story of his life. And I think that's what makes it hard for him to, you know, made it hard for him to go into some of that or to want to go into some of that because, you know, he feels like he did some stupid things that, he doesn't necessarily want to fess up to because, you know, he did everything the hard way. And it's easy to look at it when you've had advantages that he didn't have and say, why would you do it that way? You know, and he can be sort of self-effacing sometimes and or self-deprecating sometimes and say that, you know, he feels like he's not, you know, for much of his life, he just wasn't very sophisticated. But that's what makes him who he is. And I think that's what why every role he does, even when it's in a bad movie, it's really genuine. I mean, he's deadly serious about it, you know, not by choice, but because that's the only way he knows to work. But that's what works for audiences too. I mean, that's what comes across.
Right, right. So how long did this whole process take once you finally, you know, rang him up that one day and said, let's do this? How long did it finally take to actually, you know, turn over the manuscript for the editing?
I remember that we started doing the interviews, the sit-down interviews in the last week of February. And I want to say that we had a pretty solid draft by maybe September, October. So it was, but you know, part of that too is that, you know, one of Lance's other lines is, you know, at this point in my life, at this age, procrastination is not a good policy. So, I mean, he was really looking for pages, you know. I mean, we were getting together once a week and talking through a new batch of films. So I had a week to transcribe and write about, you know, what we had talked about the week before. I mean, I had to, this was a full-time job during that period.
I was going to ask if you were working on other projects at the same time, because you had talked about, you know, doing your regular work while you were doing Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue. And it's just like, I can't imagine you would you'd be able to do anything else other than transcribe interviews, watch movies, and just, yeah, write.
Yeah, I had to turn down some TV jobs, which was hard to do when we had started this out. And he's saying, you know, this may not come to anything. We may have to scrap it if I'm not feeling it. So, it was a gamble because I'm turning down paying work. But at the same time, I was getting so much out of it. It was such a great opportunity. And also, this was a book that I wanted to read. And so maybe selfishly, I was thinking, well, even if nobody else ever reads it, I want to read this book. So it was worth it to me, on every level. It was worth it for the process, even if nothing had ever come of it. I don't think I would have any regrets.
So you just went ahead and plowed forward. Did you have any idea in mind of, you know, who's going to publish this thing, or what's it going to look like, or any of that kind of stuff? Or did you just be like, okay, he's ready, let's do it?
I had some publishing ideas. I don't think I had any. I mean, I had a few different people that I was thinking about approaching, a few different companies, but I wasn't really confident that any of the ones that I knew I could get into were the right places to go. When we were done, Lance actually approached one of his agents, and we talked to a few different literary agents that he knew, and we were just sort of feeling out the publishing world to see what our options were and where we wanted to go with it, and who was interested, and several of the people that we talked to, I remember one guy in particular just saying, well, we want something that's a little more salacious. You know, we want Lance to kind of dig up a little more dirt on some of his co-stars. We want him to talk a little bit more about the sordid details of you know, his failed marriages. I mean, they wanted to go a different sort of National Enquirer route, and that was never what Lance wanted to do, and it wasn't what I wanted to do. It's not the kind of book that I wanted to read about him. I mean, it's you know, I think we were still able to do something that's really deeply, deeply personal, but without, you know, without going into that kind of stuff. I don't really see the point of that. I mean, I don't think the agent actually represented this book, but I remember him talking about the Rob Lowe thing, and I just thought, well, that's not Lance. I mean, you know, if you're going to do a biography, the first thing you have to do is be true to your subject. You know, and if your subject is really somebody who likes sort of, you know, wallowing the slime, then fine, that's your book. And, you know, if they're comfortable with that and that's what they want to do and they want to make money and they figure that's a way to make money, you know, I don't know that I would have any, you know, personal integrity problems writing a book like that. But that's not Lance, and it wouldn't have been true to Lance to do some kind of expose. You know, so that was never going to be an issue between us anyway, to try to go that route. So we ended up, you know, we got to a point where Lance just said, you know, let's do it ourselves. We've done all of this ourselves. Let's just self-publish, which opened a whole other can of worms where as soon as I started researching it and looking at that and trying to figure out what that would actually mean, you know, there went 2011 for me.
Was it just all research and trying to find the right way to go, the right company?
I mean, learning the terminology. Yeah. I mean, you know, you hear self-publishing, you know, and it's, people actually define it in different ways. I mean, I had to go out and read, you know, all of these sort of how-to books just to figure out the terminology and just to figure out all the different ways that you can get screwed by self-publishing. I mean, there actually was a lot to figure out. You know, are you actually putting, you know, your own money at stake, you know, and buying the books outright? Are you doing, you know, print on demand, which is a little lower risk, but you're going to see a smaller profit from that? I mean, that's, like I say, that's such a long conversation. I don't even, you know, that was a couple of weeks or maybe even months of just trying to figure out what the field was and what the options were and what the advantages and disadvantages were of going a lot of different directions there. So,
right. So what did you decide on?
We ended up sort of splitting the difference. We did the hardback limited edition which was through Bloody Pulp Books, which is Steve Niles's press. You know, we bought the books and we set up the website and we sold them ourselves and we took them around to conventions, and we became publishers, and we did all of our own marketing and all of our own distribution. We literally sit down and sign the books, and we mail them out ourselves. I mean, we did, you know, everything. And then we did a print on demand version, the soft cover version, which is the one that's available through Amazon and Barnes and Noble, Nook and Kindle and iPad and all of that. And that was actually done, designed, and the layout work was done by Lance's daughter, who started up her own company with her boyfriend, and they did their own company called Alexander Henriksen Press, based out of Tennessee, Nashville, Tennessee. And so we figured we'll go in both directions and see which one takes off. And they both have had advantages and disadvantages.
Right. Yeah. I've wondered how the sales were going.
We can't complain about the sales. I mean, that's for something that you get out there and get behind yourself. In a way, you know, I don't want to name any names, but we've been going around on the convention circuit and been around some other big name stars of Lance's caliber, well known genre film guys who've put out their own biographies, but put them out under a big name publisher and let them do all the work. And I think at the end of the day, we have put in a lot more time and work, obviously, than we would have otherwise. But I think you also you reap more of the benefits. So it's just a question of whether you really want to do the work. And Lance just sort of took this book on as a crusade. I mean, he figured if I'm going to write it and I'm going to tell this story, then I really want to get out there and make sure that people are getting the book, and also to find out if and how they're connecting with it. I mean, he really wanted a dialogue. So he spent most of 2011 sort of touring around with the book and just talking to people about it. And I think that was really, really gratifying for him. And he didn't have the distance between himself and the book that he would have had if, you know, Simon & Schuster had put it out.
Right. Yeah. He had some skin in the game, I suppose.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, how was the whole film festival, not film festival, but I'm sure it was more horror convention, those kind of things. How was that?
That was good. That was, I mean, Lance has done those sort of things for years. I've done them, but I'm always on the other side of the table. but that was great. I mean, it was, I think he really loved just having dialogues. I think I told him when we were writing it, I said, people are going to interact with you on a different level when they've read this book. Because he lets people in. I mean, he invites them in and he gets personal with them in the book. And that's something that's not only, that's not only difficult. I think as a fan on the other side of the table, it's not only difficult to make that kind of connection with, you know, the normal star, but with somebody like Lance, who's such a, you know, a kind of his screen persona is so intimidating that I assume, people, well, I know from having seen this that people at the beginning of the tour, were coming up who hadn't read the book, and they didn't quite know how to approach him except to say, "Oh, I loved you in this movie," but they were intimidated by him, and I think by the end of the tour, we were getting a lot of people who had read the book, and they would just walk up and hug him. You know, it's a different that they felt like they could do that. You know, he'd let his guard down, so to speak, and so other people, were approaching him without any kind of guard or without any fear that he was going to have his guard up. So
how many movies do you think that you watched while you were doing the research for this?
For Lance's book?
Yeah,
I watched all of them that I could find. I think there were two or three things there are two or three things he's done that I still haven't seen. I actually haven't seen Dark End of the Street, which was an early film he did. That was a PBS movie. What else? His very first movie, which is some kind of snowmobile melodrama. I haven't seen, but pretty much everything is available if you look hard enough. I live in LA, and there's a video store here in North Hollywood called Eddie Brandt's Saturday Matinee that has something like, I don't even know what the numbers would be, like 90,000 VHS tapes. so you can go through there, and anything that was ever put on video, or even in a lot of cases, something that was taped off a TV, you can get it from them. So I was able to track down most things. I actually went to them and asked them to track down the episode he'd done of the Sunday Showcase. It was NBC Sunday Showcase, I think, which was the thing he did in 1960, where he was in a jail in Tucson, and they used him as an extra. And all he could remember about it was that Lee Marvin, I think, was the star in it. And he just had a little, you know, he was just sort of a background character, because he happened to be there in jail while they were shooting at the jail. So I really tried to track that down, but I guess that was probably before the days when they used to put those shows on tape, or at least put them on a tape where it was going to be preserved. You know, they record over it with the next night's program. So I'm not sure it even exists anymore, but I'd love to see it if it does. So would Lance. So if anybody out there in internet land has a copy.
Yeah, I know. I've been looking for Dark End of the Street myself for a lot of years. Didn't even realize that he was in it. So that gives me even more impetus to try to hunt it down.
Yeah. Track down. I think you can, I believe the filmmaker has some kind of web presence. And I think I sent an email and was trying to get a copy through him, but I know I did never get a response, and I may not have pursued that hard enough. I wasn't as aggressive as I had been for those interviews for the horror documentary.
Right. Yeah, I remember, I think I remember there was a screening in Boston at Harvard years and years ago of that and another film that he had done. So mm-hmm. I think they exist someplace, but exists. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, just too tough to find. All right, so I have to ask, what's next? I mean, how much longer? At some point, you're going to have to say, okay, that's the end of the Lance Henriksen project. Obviously not the end of your friendship, but at some point it's going to ramp down. What do you have your sights set on next? Or are you still just so immersed in this that that's the only thing you can see?
No, I think we started to ramp down a little bit actually when we finished doing the book tour, which I think was the end of October. Although we then started to ramp up on a new project, a new collaboration for a comic book for Dark Horse, which is still in process. We're definitely in the thick of that of developing that, and I'm not at liberty to give out any juicy details on that one, but it is in process, and we're both actively working on that, and I've got quite a few other things that in a way I feel like have been on hold for about 2 years. I did do some TV work in the fall. I actually worked with my wife, who's a TV producer, on an investigation discovery series, new series about hostage negotiators. So I sort of dipped back into that world for a while, but I'm sort of always in the back of my head thinking about the next two or three books. And I've written actually half of a book, the first draft of a book on Westerns. So I'm probably, when January rolls around, if I have enough time away from the comic, I'm going to really try to buckle down and get through the second half of that. And if you think I watched a lot of movies for the Lance book, just imagine what it's like trying to do 100 years of Westerns.
So your wife, is she a Lance Henriksen fan?
My wife is ironically not really a genre fan in general. So all of my favorite things, horror movies and science fiction and Westerns and cheesy action movies are pretty much the things that she steers clear of. So I tend to kind of binge on those whenever she goes out of town or works late. But she's certainly become a fan of Lance as a person, you know, that we've spent enough time with him, and she went to a bunch of the conventions with us. We actually got her to Comic-Con in San Diego, which I never thought would happen in a million years, that my wife would go to Comic-Con, but she did, and we had fun. So.
Well, that's good. Yeah, there's always that line between, you know, what movies you can watch upstairs and which ones you have to be locked away in the basement to watch.
Right.
You know, my wife would be fine with Millennium. In fact, she's a big fan. But when it came to Near Dark, I think she'd be okay with. But there are a lot of others where she'd be like, get downstairs.
You get banished to the basement, huh?
Exactly. Or I just wait until bowling night, so which is tonight. So I'll be watching a little bit of Chicken Park after I get done talking to you.
Well, this is a good setup then, I suppose.
Exactly. All right. Well, thank you so much. Just for the folks listening at home, give us your website one time where folks can go and pick up Not Bad for a Human.
Sure. It's easy. It's just notbadforahuman.com. And we're selling the book through there, and we try to keep with, certainly with the comic, we'll be putting up news on that as it develops. And well, if this is going up before New Year's, we actually have a contest going on the website right now for a signed copy of the book, actually the dust jacket of the book, and it's signed by me and Lance and Steve Niles, who's the publisher. And all of the artists who did drawings in the books, all big names in comics. So all of those guys have signed a dust jacket that we're going to give away on probably the 1st of January. So anybody who orders a book between now and then gets entered to win.
Yeah, those drawings are just amazing. I love the Mike Mignola. Just all of it is so great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We got... That was Steve Niles who sort of pulled all that together. We ended up with Steve Niles as a publisher, actually, because Lance didn't want to use publicity stills. And I knew Steve from another project, from a TV project, and went to him and said, do you have any artist buddies who would be interested in doing some drawings of Lance or a drawing of Lance for the book? And he said, yeah, I think I can come up with a few people who would go for that. So, that ended up being how we started down the road towards him publishing the hardcover, the limited edition under his new label imprint. Well, all of those guys are just fantastic, too. I mean, they all kind of came on board because they had a respect for Lance. And we made a very conscious effort when we were going around doing all the convention appearances on the book tour of whenever we were closest to those guys, sort of arranging a get together so that they could meet in person. And every one of them was just, they were just great human beings. And I think probably that's why we're sort of dipping our toe into the comic world a little bit more, I guess, is because we had such a great experience with those guys.
Very cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to me tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Your head from your shoulders.
Do it fast.
All right.
The times roll. No. You might as well just kill me then, too.
Caleb Colton no longer belongs to our world.
We'll give him a week, see if we can call him one of us.
He belongs to hers.
But you have to learn to kill.
He belongs to theirs.
I don't want to kill.
He makes you kill tonight.
And they all belong to the night.
It's 3 hours short for a bus to get home. You help me out?
What are you on?
Believe me, I told you.
Don't think of it as killing.
Amen.
Don't think at all. It's just something that you do night after night. It's only ever a question of how.
Nervous? I would be too if I were you.
Near Dark.
Could be your boys falling in the control.
Check out time.
Bought yourself some time, son.
God damn, this is my family. Let him go.
This is my town! You live to see the dawn, it's because I allow it!
I decide who lives or who dies.
In a town called Redemption, death is a way of life. Some fight for money. Some fight for glory. But one stranger has come here looking for something else.
I now declare the quick draw competition open. Anybody can challenge anybody.
Sign me up.
Sure must want to die young, miss.
She can play their game.
Want to play poker with me, little lady?
Looks like you're having a pretty good time playing with yourself.
She can beat their odds.
Did you ever kill anyone?
Sure.
I don't think you have.
But there's one thing she can't do.
Why are you really here? You're no gunfighter.
Forget the past.
Daddy! Bring him up! Put him on a chair!
Some people deserve to die.
TriStar Pictures presents Sharon Stone.
I'm gonna kill you if I have to ride all the way to hell to do it.
Gene Hackman.
There's nothing on this earth that frightens me now. Nothing.
Leonardo DiCaprio.
Hey, my man.
In a film by Sam Raimi. The Quick and the Dead. In this town, you're either one or the other.
Just tell me one thing, Burke. You're going out there to destroy them, right? Not to study, not to bring back, but to wipe them out.
That's the plan.
All right, people, on the ready line. Yeah. Iron me!
Yeah!
Iron
yeah.
me!
Yeah!
Where are you?
Talk to me, Hudson!
I got signals. I got readings in front and behind.
There's nothing back here.
Look, I'm telling you, there's something moving and it ain't us.
Get them out of there!
They got the power.
How could they cut the power, man? They're animals.
There's movement all over the place! 5 meters, man! 4!
Aliens. This time, it's war. In the city of New Orleans, in a darker side of Dixie, away from the music and the lights, there's a new game in town.
You'll be provided with a guide, trackers, and the weapons of your choice.
I need to file a missing person report.
The competitors are deadly.
We pride ourselves in hunting only combat veterans, men who have the necessary skills to make our hunts more interesting.
And they always win.
You want to find your father? Get somebody who knows the city to show you around.
Now, the opposition is about to get one last chance.
What kind of a name is Chance?
My mama took one.
My friend, Mr. Boudreaux. Silver Star, Marine Force Recon. He's obviously not someone we should underestimate. He is an annoying little insect. Now I'm stepped on hard.
We need to get out of here now.
Ladies first.
What?
These men will chase after you. You mad at you for business or pleasure?
Both. Look at it this way. You're gonna get to meet Elvis.
Give it a rest, pal.
Jean-Claude Van Damme is the hard target.
You miss me?
From internationally acclaimed action director John Woo.
How's it feel to be hunted?
You tell me!
Hard Target.
Afraid raising the dead ain't within my power.
Will it be all right? Should I be afraid?
It's coming!
Looking for an old woman. She lives somewhere in the mountains hereabouts.
All she can do is take you straight to hell. You go home and you bury your boy.
Some folks say it's how she's got powers.
Who are you?
Ed Harley.
What do you want, Ed Harley? Say it. You're looking for vengeance. Vengeance. Say it. There's no graveyard way back deep in them woods. The thing you're looking for is in there.
It was an accident.